Welcome to My Pocket Psych, the podcast all about the psychology of the workplace. Each episode focuses on aspects of work that can sometimes cause us problems, explain why that's the case, and offer some advice on what you can do about it. We'll highlight the areas of working life where you can make a positive change. We want to help you move from surviving work to thriving at work. And we'll avoid fads and nonsense that are spread on the internet. We'll minimize the psychobabble and we'll involve the experts and share it all with you in a sensible and accessible way. I'm Dr. Richard McKinnon. I'm the Managing Director of Work Life Psych. And here's my co-host, Pilar Ortiz. Hi, Pilar.
Hi, Richard. Hi, listeners. What's the focus of today's episode, Richard?
So today, as per the last few episodes, we're going to have two main areas of focus. First of all, we're going to look at work-life balance. This is a topic that comes up again and again in the work that I do. It's also something that interests me personally. So given how big that is, I'm sure there'll be a lot to discuss. And then we're going to go back and look at psychological flexibility again. And this is going to be the third of the three conversations we'll have about this, at least planned conversations. I'm sure we will come back to it. We've already looked at the first two, how to show up and be more mindful and present, and how to let go of the difficult interactions that we have with our thoughts and our emotions. And this time we're going to look at the third part, which is to get moving, which is about getting clarity on our values and putting those into practice.
Excellent. But before we kick off, Richard, isn't there something that you want to share that might be of interest to our listeners around psychological flexibility?
Well, the fact that we've been talking about it, yes, there is, in answer to your question. The fact that we've been talking about it reflects the fact that we're running a campaign about psychological flexibility at the moment, and that's taking several forms. So one of the main things is we've put a guide together on psychological flexibility. And you can download that for free from the website. That's at worklifepsych.com/psychological flexibility. And we'll put the link to that in the show notes. But effectively, that provides a neat summary of these three conversations that we're having about showing up, letting go, and getting moving. And what's really nice is I shared the link to that on LinkedIn the other day, and it was part of the campaign. Look, there's a whole different community out on LinkedIn. A lot of my peers are out there, a lot of other psychologists and HR practitioners. Let me put it out there. And I'm kind of taken aback with the feedback. It's been really positive. It's been shared all over the place. And the post has been viewed over 4,000 times. Wow. So I think this concept about understanding how you can deal with challenges and deal with your inner life, I think it's proving really popular.
Yeah, it's really resonating. I think one, it's got the word flexibility in it, which a lot of us like. Anything that means that we can adapt is very attractive. And then you've got psychological, so it means that it's not going to be a quick fix. The term really invites you to start thinking, actually. So I'm not surprised.
No, it's good. And people have emphasized the practical nature of this guide and people are putting it into practice. And I've had some feedback from people I met at a conference just a few weeks ago who, by the by, downloaded it. And on a call, they told me how they'd made use of these concepts already. So that's really what it's about. It's about putting it out there, letting people have a go and seeing how well it works for them. So I'm really pleased about that. So if you're listening to this and you're intrigued, download the guide, have a look and get in touch with any questions or feedback that you might have.
Excellent. So worklifepsych.com/, what was it?
Psychological flexibility, all one word.
Excellent. And one thing, Richard, when you go to the, when you follow that link and you enter your email to download the PDF, there's also another PDF which has some cards.
And that's what we're going to talk about today. Yes, absolutely. These are our cards. It's a really simple simple exercise that if you download that PDF and you print it out and cut it up along the guidelines, you have a set of dozens of values that you know, people may have. And you can use that set of cards to help you identify your most important values. And so later on in this podcast, we're going to talk about why that's important. And that's just a really simple way of putting it out there for people to use. Because if I said to you, Pilar, I take a blank sheet of paper and write down your values for me, that's a bit of a challenge. Whereas if you've got a few dozen of cards to sort through, it can make it a little bit easier for you.
Yeah, that's a really, really good idea. I had a look and I thought, wow. And then I saw we were talking about it today. So I thought I'd just bring it up in case people have already gone to the website to download it. They found the cards. Wonderful. Anything else around that, Richard?
It was just a couple of weeks ago, I was presenting at Google's Campus London, which is a sort of a startup accelerator space. And I was the guest of the guys who've launched an app called Wise Amigo. And I was there to talk about productivity in the startup space, about how you can keep productive while everything is going on around you. What was really interesting was, even though I was talking about some productivity principles, lots of the questions that people had afterwards were about our old friend email. which we've discussed before. And while I talked about, you know, the very conceptual nature of being productive, because you can't make rules and expect everyone to follow the same rules, lots of the questions were really similar. Distractions from technology, dealing with email pressure, and dealing with interruptions from other people. So rather than discuss that today, we are going to have an episode all about these principles of productivity, but I have written it up in a blog post, and we'll put a link to that blog post in the show notes for this episode.
Wonderful. And listeners, if you have any more questions after the episode on email or after reading this post, if you have any questions, send them through. Richard will answer them.
someone will answer them. we've got a contact form on the website, or you can simply send us a tweet at WorkLifeSec.
Great. Good. Well, is it time to start with the main body of the episode?
Let's talk about work-life balance. So, you know, this is huge. This is a really big topic. And I'm going to start by saying something pretty controversial. I don't think there's any such thing as work-life balance. I think this is a terrible term. Unfortunately, it's the term that we all use to describe this. It's often used in organizations. It's still used out there in academia to a certain extent. And I think it's terrible for a few reasons. We've touched on this, you and I, Pilar, in our conversations before. Balance, you know, when we talk about balance, it implies 50-50, doesn't it?
And yeah.
That's not what everybody wants. Balance also implies that some kind of balance is either achievable or desirable. And it implies that's it fixed. Once you have balance, you have balance. And of course, we know that that's not the case. Life is very dynamic. And so the attainment of balance is probably something that no one's going to be able to get forever. So the balance word is problematic. Unfortunately, so are the other two words, work and life, to be really blunt, because, you know, work is part of life. And it implies that you have work and then you have a life. And words are really important. The words we use to describe things are really important. So balance, not great. Work-life, work being part of life, we could maybe make the distinction between your work life and your non-work life. But another topic or term that's used a lot is work-family balance. And I think that excludes a lot of people who wouldn't see themselves as having a traditional family, in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. One doesn't need the presence of a spouse and or children to deserve some kind of personal life. So, and I think this influences organizations' policies and how people think of work-life balance. So I want to, you know, really challenge some of that stuff today. But we're starting on a sour note. The terminology is terrible. But you know what? For the rest of this, let's maybe agree that if we stumble over work-life balance, that's because we've used this phrase thousands of times before today.
Yeah, I think it also comes, hearing you talk about it, from a mindset where work was one thing that you had to do and it was a very specific kind of activity and life was what you did that you had control over. And at the moment, I think it's allowed, now you're allowed to say you enjoy your work. You're allowed to talk about happiness at work. And therefore, there's not that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff that it reflects. Let me see. We don't have to use it today, but I have a word that just came to mind, which I quite liked. So I was in, I was in a meetup yesterday by the International Association of Facilitators, where they organized like a really peer learning thing. And they were talking about a different topic. It had to do with gender and sexuality. And somebody was talking about female and the male aspects of ourselves and how they need to be in. And somebody said, balance. And someone said, no. And the person took it and said, no, harmony. And I really like that. And hearing you talk about it, I wonder, because then that harmony means different things to different people. But it sits well. So I quite like, I am going to start seeing if I can push that a little bit.
You need to, you can start the campaign. Harmony implies that it's an ongoing journey.
Yes.
That it changes from day to day and month to month. And, other people researchers, academics, practitioners, they refer to work-life navigation. Navigating the challenges that come up. And it's all about how you do that rather than achieving an end goal.
Yes.
Or work-life integration. That's another nice phrase. These are experiences that we as one person have. So, it is about integrating those aspects of our life. And I really advocate when I'm working with teams on productivity or individuals working on work-life balance, having a really healthy focus on the distribution of their attention on the roles they have in life and the goals they want to achieve, rather than it being a kind of a black and white work and personal. Actually, we all have multiple roles when we think about it. You might have a formal role in work, sure, but you might have other roles within your job that are maybe less formal, but there'll be work associated with them. And you'll have multiple roles outside of the workplace. And if you just think of work and non-work, those roles, those responsibilities, those interests can easily fall off the edge of the table. They don't get the attention that they may deserve. And that's when you can end up waking up one day saying, how did I get here? Mm-hmm. Work has taken over my life. And I've fallen out of touch with my friends. My family never see me. I used to be a great sports person. I never paint anymore. That kind of scenario. It's really, really common. And it's because the individuals have ended up with an oversimplified view of life. And it's about work and recovery from work. And that's not healthy.
Oh, sorry.
It's not healthy. That's all I was going to say.
Yes, I love the distribution of attention that you mentioned. And also I would add in the same way, because I feel that the work-life balance, when we talk about it, it's mainly got to do about the fact that we're lacking the outside of work life, whereas the opposite can also happen. We can be concentrating so much on our stuff outside of work that we lose, we don't distribute our attention as much to the work side. And then suddenly we realize, actually, this is not how I want to lead my life. My work, I've really let go of my work. So really, really interesting.
It work can be a refuge for some people from their personal lives. When their personal life is really not going well, the stability of the workplace can be a great place to spend some time and get some enjoyment and satisfaction from. So it's definitely not the case that work is a negative thing that makes our private lives tough because we bring work home with us. It can happen in either direction, this notion of overspill from one part of our life to the other. And that overspill can also be positive as well as negative. I mean, we can all imagine, well, I've had to bring home a load of paperwork from the office and now I'm sitting at my kitchen table doing paperwork and that's annoying my other half and I'm missing out on my hobbies. Okay, that we can easily imagine that. But the positive overspill from work could be bringing home a great mood because you've had a successful day. It could be bringing home or to your private life skills that you've acquired, and you can use them in your personal life. It could be personal attributes like confidence and leadership skills, or technical skills that you're able to use in your personal life. And of course, home life isn't always perfect. And so you can bring some of the downsides of that into your work life. It might be some, you know, fractious conversations at home and you bring your bad mood in, or it can be you bring your concerns and your worries to the workplace. And that's where the notion of attention comes in. You can be present. You can be physically there, but you're not psychologically there. You're not giving attention to the thing at hand, whether it's work or it's personal. And that's where the boundaries between work and non-work are really important. Mm-hmm. And awareness of, am I actually here? What am I thinking about? Where is my focus right now?
Mm. Yeah, I think you mentioned boundaries. And you mentioned when they are important. I think this is key, is to understand when this concept is important and what it means to us and why it's important. I think what's coming out is that it's very personal, isn't it, Richard?
It's hugely personal, hugely subjective. I might say to you, I mean, a very common conversation is for people to talk about work-life balance and discuss the hours that they work. Mm-hmm. But the hours that you work are only one part of the puzzle. They really are, because you might work few hours, but actually really hate your job. And so that's going to have an impact on your perceived work-life balance. You could work many, many, many hours in the week and love the state of your work-life balance. It works for you because of who you are. And of course, boundaries mean the boundaries between work and non-work are subjective, and they're about preference. So I might want to keep some very firm boundaries between work and home. And that means, Pilar, if I work for you and you call me on a Friday night on my mobile, mm-hmm. and I'm at home, I'll be really put out by that. And that will upset me. I mightn't tell you, but I'll really feel that you've impinged on my private time. If that boundary for me isn't so firm, if it's not so impenetrable, if I can see myself integrating work and non-work, I don't mind if you call me in the evening if it's important and we can make some progress on something. At the same time, when I'm at work, I might take a short break to address a personal task or take a personal phone call, because I see work and non-work kind of flipping around on a regular basis. But if I have a perspective that I want to segregate these two big parts of my life, then I really do try to keep them separate. And when I'm at work, I'm at work. And when I'm not at work, I really don't want work interfering. And the problem with this is that that's okay, but does your role allow you to keep that kind of segregation or that integration? It really depends on the job that you do and where you do it.
Mm. This conversation is reminding me of the one we had around email. It's really interesting. Yeah.
I mean, you know, email is an example of the way technology has made our focus on the integration of work and non-work such an important one, because the technology has facilitated our capability to work from anywhere. And that's great, but it can sort of remove those residual boundaries and leave us working longer hours than we might like, or working in a way that's not sustainable and not healthy for us, even though we like it. Whereas if the technology hadn't been there, or we weren't working flexibly, we might have had the feedback from those around us. We might have had the visual cues. People were going home, lights were turning off. And so it's got pluses, and it's definitely got minuses. But it's just one part of it, because we can't blame email for all of the problems we have with work-life balances. Big societal changes have happened over the last 20 to 25 years, which means that work is much more unpredictable. You know, we don't all go to work at 9 and finish at 5 or anything like that anymore. And we're working with people all around the world in different time zones. And we have the capability, whether we like it or not, to bring work away from the workplace with us. It might be in an absolute sense, we might be physically bringing work home to complete, or we're psychologically bringing our experience of work home with us to either solve some problems, or it's like a psychological hangover. We're still worrying, we're still concerned, we're still upset about something that's happened from work. And so the interaction between work and non-work, it's something that's really important to give some thought to and not have a simplistic, how many hours am I putting in?
So what are some of the things, some of the questions that listeners can be asking if they feel in some shape or form that there is this, I'm going to say this, disharmony in the activities or in how they are running their life?
So what's really important is to give some thought to what the problem is. So to be specific about what's not working for you. So it might be you find you're spending too much time at work. And you're really clear about that. You are unhappy with maybe the amount of overtime you're doing, or maybe you're unhappy with the length of your commute and your, you know, your time at home or for your personal pursuits is limited. But it might not just be about time. It might be about the demands placed on you. So being specific about, is it a workload issue? You know, you might finish work at a time that suits you, but if you're too exhausted to enjoy your personal life, that's also problematic. So it might be the demands or the nature of the job itself. Is it the psychological overspill? Do you find yourself thinking about work outside of work or thinking about home while at work? Let's remember it can work in either direction. And this is problematic if the overspill is negative. You know, if you're ruminating over problems from the workplace, or you're sitting at your desk really concerned about stuff that's happening in your private life. So be clear about the nature of this problem, the direction of the problem. Imagine someone was going to ask you to describe it for them. You know, what is the thing that's not working so well here? And I have to be really blunt. A lot of the time that I work with individuals on a work-life balance issue, it also stems from not that the effort that they're putting into work, but how they organize themselves at work, how productive they are. So their long hours often stem from, you know, not prioritizing the right things at the right time, being too easily distracted or spending too long on activities that don't really add much value. But they are work, but maybe busy work. So be honest with yourself about, am I focused when I'm in one environment or another? And if I had to identify some root causes here, what might they be? Now, something that we as people do a lot is make comparisons with other people. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a conversation I have a lot because it's natural. You know, we might work together and I look at you and you say, my God, Pilar manages to leave the office at 5:30 on the dot every day. She has the perfect work-life balance. But then I don't see, one, what's going on in your head, and two, what you do at home. So you might be really quite worried about your ability to stay on top. And while I'm having dinner at home, you are opening your laptop again and, you know, tapping away and working and all the rest of it. So because this is so subjective, it's about the individual. Don't try not to make those comparisons. Now, one thing you can do is if someone who looks like they're doing it really well and they've got it all sewn up is talk to them about it. Ask them how they make it work. There might be able to things. You might be able to duplicate some of the things that they do. You might learn from them, but they're a different person and they have a different life. So don't assume that there's a magic formula that you can adopt. I think that the other big thing is to think about what's amenable to change. What is it in your daily routine? What is it in the nature of your job? What is it about your personal life that you could maybe adjust to see if you could improve the situation, but also be honest about what's out of your control? You know, people can beat themselves up about being slightly late for work because they're stuck in traffic. You know, the traffic wasn't their fault and they can't improve that situation. But what you might start looking at is there another way I can get to work? Could I use public transport? Do I need to leave earlier? Could I look at maybe some flexible hours that might allow me to skip this rush hour, come in a little bit later and leave a little bit later? I'm not a big fan of massive changes when it comes to this. It's about small adjustments to find a way of easing through the tension between work and non-work. Sorry, go ahead. I can hear a question.
Well, it was more a reflection on the small changes because you're you're mentioning some small practical changes, but actually for me the first big change is the mindset, and it is identifying exactly what it is that's bothering you about it, and that can be quite huge. But then how you act on it then doesn't need to be big, which I think, if I were thinking about this for myself, I rarely think about this, but if I was thinking for it, I would think, oh, well, that's great, because I can take that leap. I can make myself have the time to think about it. But then I don't need to do huge changes that are going to affect everyone around me about it. So I really like that perspective.
But you make a hugely valid point that mindset's really important here. I don't think I've ever worked with a client where just making some small changes to their routine has been what's made the difference. It's their thinking, their attitude. And it can boil down to, well, the reason, you know, I work so many hours and I'm always thinking about work is I can't trust my team. Yeah. Whoa, that's that's quite a big thing to carry around. Yeah. Or I have to do it all.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I have to be perfect. And so I have to put the hours in. Or, you know, the business will suffer if I'm not available 24/7. And these are thoughts that are banging around inside their head, which influence their behavior, which manifest in a way that they say, you know, my work-life balance really sucks. But you have the conversation about why, and it's, no one is, you know, holding a gun to their head at the desk. They have some very strongly held beliefs about how things should be. And so addressing the mindset and the thinking is a really good place to start to free you up to try new ways of being. And that's what it boils down to.
Yeah. Great. Were you going to say something different before I interrupted you?
Well, I mean, it is around how you think about it. So if you find that you're, for example, with that example, putting in lots of hours, you know, you could do something as simple as track your hours. What are you doing with your time when you're at work and when you're not at work? We're, as humans, we're lousy at estimating how long things are going to take, and also remembering where our time went, because our calendars that we have at work are often just works of fiction. You know, it's a nice aspiration. That's how my week will be. If you look each day and see, actually, how did I spend my time? You might identify some ways of being more efficient. You might identify some things that you're doing that you shouldn't be doing in the first place. Someone else could do, or it's not adding any value. So there's a level of productivity and efficiency that you can examine, but it can make you more mindful about where your time does go, so that when you want to have a conversation with your manager, for example, you can talk facts rather than, I have a vague feeling that it's not working, because that will not be a positive conversation. You can also get some feedback from other people. And are they noticing? Have they got ideas? Is there something about the way you do things that they think you could make some changes? And if you have a plan, if you know what you need to work on, if you have a plan for your personal life, and that can sound really controlling, but, you know, the tasks, the goals you have, the projects you want to work on, if you have those recorded, it could be in a notebook, it could be in some kind of crazy master spreadsheet. But once they're out of your head, and they're down on paper or they're electronic, you can start to work towards them. And you now have a planned approach to how you want to do things. And I really advocate that my clients do that for their personal life as well as their professional life, so that those goals, those personal projects, they don't just fall off the edge of the table because other things push them off and work things. So try and quantify this. Try and be specific about it. Don't aim for huge changes. Try small things, and, you know, don't look at other people for an idealized view. Think about how it would work for you, and that's the goal to work towards.
The plan aspect, it feels to me like a lot of the time when this subject comes up, it's because there's a sense of loss of control, or that something else has taken over how we spend our time. So to have a plan, I can see how even that can really, as well as make you think, can really go, okay, now I'm going to be the one who decides what I'm doing with my time.
Yeah, and work towards that. You know, feelings like regret and guilt are really not helpful, and they're not pleasant. And so if we want to have less regret and guilt about what we're not doing, we then make those a priority alongside our other priorities and be realistic about what can and can't be done, and work towards them all. Because, you know, waking up one day with the, how did I get here? I have no personal life. Or how did I get here? My career isn't going the way I want it to go. That's never going to feel good. So having a plan, working towards it, being mindful about what you're doing, not just going with the flow. Those things can help you be more realistic and more in touch with how the different roles that you occupy are taking your time, your attention and your energy.
Wonderful. Well, I am looking forward to making the links between this and the next section, because I think there's going to be a lot of crossover, at least in my mind. But before that, you have here a note about a book that maybe you'd like to recommend to our listeners.
I consistently recommend a book to clients where they're trying to figure out how they can make the interface between work and their personal lives just work a little bit better. And it's called The CEO of Me. By Ellen Ernst Cossack, an amazing academic in this space. She conducts really insightful research and communicates it brilliantly. So a bit of a fanboy moment there. And I've had the pleasure to meet her. She's amazing. And the other author, Brenda Louch. The two of them have put together a great book, which is more like a workbook. You work through it, you answer questions, it helps you identify things like, well, do you like to integrate work and non-work, or do you prefer to segregate it? And actually, if that's your preference, let's look at your role and how workable that is. And it gives you strategies, and it's all evidence-based. It's based on some really good science. So rather than top five tips to improve your work-life balance, I recommend putting the time into reading this book, work through the exercises, and make a plan off the back of that. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Wonderful. Well, listeners, if you have anything that you'd like to share with us, sorry, that was a bit unarticulated. If there's anything that you'd like to share with us, then worklifepsych.com, there is a contact form there. Tell us what you think and tell us whether you've addressed this issue, and also tell us what you call it, if you call it anything.
Words are really important. Yes. Yeah. So shall we move on to our third discussion around psychological flexibility? And I'll say it again, if this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, welcome. Thank you. But you might want to listen to the previous two episodes where we've really gone into some depth around the concept of psychological flexibility and the first two themes within it, because we've already discussed the importance of showing up or being mindfully present, increasing your present moment awareness, and how that's helpful, and how you can let go of difficult or unhelpful thoughts and emotions, disentangling yourself from the things that you hear in your head that aren't really helpful. So it might be useful to go back and listen to those now, or listen to this and then go back. But to get the full picture, this and the previous two episodes are a package, and you could and probably should also download the psychological flexibility guide from the website, which brings it all together and poses a few questions for you and also a couple of reflective exercises as well. This last part is get moving. Show up, let go, get moving. Get moving is about being clear on your values as a person, and then putting them into practice on a regular basis. And the research tells us that if you can take values-based action, you know, if you act in alignment with your values, the more you can do that, the better your life satisfaction is, your perceived well-being, lots of good things associated with putting your values at the base of your decisions and guiding your actions. Now, a question for you, if you're not using your values to help you make decisions and shape your behavior, what might you be using?
Your gut.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the moment, the gut could take the form of an emotion, and an emotion that's not really based on good quality information. It's the opposite of being rational. And so if we use a passing unhelpful emotion to guide our behavior, we're not going to get an ideal result, or a result that we'll be proud of, that we'll look back on with joy, possibly a result that we'll need to apologize for later. So this whole idea is get moving in the direction of valued outcomes, you know, goals that you want to work towards, using your values to guide your behavior and not using passing thoughts, passing emotions. And that's why this is really, really important. Now, when talking about this, you kind of need to start with saying, well, what are values? Because like I said at the start, if I gave you a blank sheet of paper and said, write down your values, that might be a bit of a challenge and a little bit uncomfortable, because values aren't something that we talk about in the workplace all that much.
We talk a lot about the company's values, as I'm hearing you. And this is really interesting because I wonder how much we are encouraged to think about our own personal values, which sometimes might be in conflict with where we're working.
They could definitely be different. And in a given moment, you might feel conflict. But you may also feel conflict between your values, your own personal values. So the first distinction I would make is between values and goals.
Oh, yeah.
That's one thing that people often mix up. So getting a promotion is not a personal value. It's a goal. It's attainable, because when you get that promotion, you can tick a box. But being professional, being available, caring for others in your community, they're values, because there isn't really an end point to those. There isn't a point at which you can say, tick the box, that's done, now let's move on. They're patterns of behavior to which we aspire. We're not necessarily doing them 24/7, but they're how we would like to be rather than something we would like to have. Does that make sense, the difference between values and goals?
It's very clear, at least for me. Listeners, if it's not clear, let us know. Or rewind.
Listening to me again. Wow.
Yes, it's clear.
But when I talk to individuals, I talk to groups about what their values are, that can be quite a challenging conversation. So you need to leave some time for that. And that's where those cards that we mentioned at the outset can be really useful. Sorting a deck of cards with the names and definitions of values on them into piles of, this is not important to me at all, but this is important. In this pile, these are the really important values, the things that I figure as being really important guiding principles. I want to look like these things as much as I possibly can. And it's important that we then get in touch with those values and we live them more often so that we're able to use them when times are tough. I think I've used this analogy before. When you jump off the end of the pier, it's a bit late to consider getting swimming lessons.
Yes. Yeah.
So practicing putting your values into practice on a very regular basis will then allow you to use them when you encounter a setback, a challenge, a difficult conversation. You'll be guided by the values, not by the emotion that you might feel in the moment. We use the image of a compass to describe values. And in the guide, I talk about the imagery of a boat at sea. And boats, ships, I'm really loose on the terminology here. Sorry to maritime listeners. But the crew use the compass to guide their course. And that ensures that they're always heading in the direction they want to go. Now, when that crew and their ship hit a storm, and the storm is really intense and visibility is poor and they can't see the horizon and they can't see the stars, they can still use the compass to ensure they're going in the direction that they want to, the valued direction, whatever that direction is. That's what our values are like for us, an internal compass that even when your inner voice, your self-talk is being really negative or filling you with doubt and your emotions are in turmoil, falling back in your values gives you that clear line of sight to where you want to get to. And that means you can do the correct thing, the thing that you identify with, rather than the easy thing. And the easy thing, we can all think of those examples. The easy thing is losing our temper on the phone. It's sending the slightly spiky email to someone. It's slamming the door. Or, as we've said before, it's saying, oh no, I'm fearful of that if that doesn't work, so I won't try it. So that's easy. Rather than, no, I really want to do that. That's actually something I really want to get to. And I am worried and I'm concerned about how it'll feel, but they're just feelings. This is the direction of where I want to get to. My values are guiding me. So think about that inner compass, getting in touch with that inner compass, and then living it a little bit every day means that it's more about what you do as well as who you are.
If it seems to me like if you have clarity on your values, you always have a point of reference to come back to, which means you can have that flexibility. I think that's where very clearly now the word flexibility, I'm understanding exactly what we mean. We know in which direction we're going because we know who we want to be or who we want to sustain being. And then how we operate around that, there is some room to maneuver. But because we know very clearly who we want to be, we know how much we can maneuver. I really like that, the compass and the storm.
And also we have the choice. Yes. We have the choice not to behave in a way that our self-talk, our thoughts are telling us. You know, you should be furious right now. How dare they talk to you like that? We have the choice to say, all right, well, that's going to pass. And, you know, I want to be collegiate and supportive. So I'm going to let what they said pass because they probably didn't mean it. And I'm going to ask them some questions rather than I'm going to lose my temper. And then we'll all waste time being annoyed at each other. So it's giving you the flexibility of options and always giving you that choice to behave in a way that's important to you, that is based on values, and that's not based on a passing blip of emotion or an unhelpful thought. And so hopefully you can see that getting moving in the direction of things that are important is the really important element of this. You can be mindful and be present, and you can disentangle yourself from thoughts and feelings that are maybe unhelpful in the moment. But without action, none of this is as impactful. So taking action and moving in a valued direction is really important.
Mm. Wow, that's for me, it's completed the psychological flexibility circle.
And so putting them into action is quite straightforward in the sense that, again, we're not asking people to make massive life changes at all. What we're suggesting is that each of us look at a value at a time. One of the values that we've identified in our list of most important values, and think about how you can put that into daily practice. What's the small thing that you could do that is a behavior that represents that value in action? And so we're building up habits, values-based habits, and then we can add to that repertoire of habits with other values-based habits so that our life day-to-day is more a function of those values than a function of volatile emotions or worrying and unhelpful thoughts. So don't imagine big life-changing changes to your daily routine. Small things, frequent and often, will get you a better result here.
Mm-hmm. Very much in line with what we were saying about the work-life balance, harmony, whatever. It's all. I think it really resonating anyway through all the episodes that it really is about understanding the context yourself and then being very clear about what you want to change and that it doesn't have to be huge.
So if you've listened to these episodes and you've read the guide about psychological flexibility and you're putting this into practice, we'd love to hear from you. Yes. We'd love to hear your examples, your successes, your experiences of this. Obviously, let us know if we can share them on a future podcast. But we'd love to hear from you, even if you don't want them to go public. And please come to us with your questions about any aspect of this, if it's not making sense immediately, or if you've got something and you know, is this a goal? Is this a value? Or putting it into practice. That's what this entire initiative is about, is putting more people in touch with these really useful concepts so they can have a better experience of life. So get in touch however you would like to do that, and we'll do our very best to answer your questions.
Great. And on top of that, if there's anything that you'd like us to discuss on future episodes, anything you've always wanted to know about psychology, or a topic that you'd like us to cover, or Richard to speak about, or someone else to come and speak on the podcast about, then let us know. worklifepsych.com. There's a contact form there. Richard, anything else you want to say to our listeners before we say goodbye?
Well, let's wrap up with 2 points. Psychological flexibility is something we've talked about quite a bit over the last few weeks. We've gone out with the guide, you've got your values cards, we've got a number of blog posts there that bring some of these concepts to life as well. That's content. The difference is putting it into practice. So, you know, read it all if it's of interest to you, but the secret is in the doing. So put it into practice and you know, be kind to yourself. If it's proving difficult at first, it could be a big change for you to think about your own thinking, or, you know, face up to the fact that some of your values, you're not as in touch with them as you might want to be. Go gentle on yourself and try it anyway and keep going. I think the second point is around this notion of work-life balance. There is no perfect recipe for success. So challenge anyone who tells you they've got 3 top tips to make your life better around work-life balance, and think about what you're doing with your limited resources of time, physical energy, and mental focus or attention. Where are they going and where would you like them to go? That can be a really nice place to start when you're making some changes to the integration or the interface between your professional and your private life.
Wonderful. Well, listeners, invitation again to get in touch if you have any more questions. Richard, shall we say goodbye to our listeners and give them a big thank you for listening?
A huge thank you for listening. If you've made it this far, thank you very much.